This podcast is brought to you by Deepbridge Capital LLP. Deepbridge is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Please note that investments discussed are both illiquid and high risk and won't be suitable for all investors and should be considered as part of a diversified portfolio. The content of this podcast should not be construed as financial or taxation advice. We recommend investors seek appropriate professional financial advice. Any views expressed may no longer be current and may have already been acted upon. Hi, I'm Andrew Aldridge.
And I'm Olivia Drinnen.
Welcome to this Deepbridge Discovery podcast. In this episode, we're delighted to be joined by Gordon Bateman, who's CEO at CRSI, founder of Investor Ladder, and also founder of Climb 23, which will this year be Climb 24. You can see what they did there.
Hi, Gordon. Thank you so much for coming on to the Deepbridge podcast today. We're really excited about chatting to you. Just before we do, please, can you sort of introduce yourself, just a bit about you?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for inviting me on. I'm always humbled to be asked to do these things. So thank you very much. So my name's Gordon Bateman. I'm founder of two organisations. I guess my day job is a company called CRSI, which for the last 20 years have been working with the risk capital, so venture capital, business angels and private equity, to help accelerate the growth of their portfolio businesses by developing, designing, building and managing high performing teams, off the back of which I then, by accident, and I always say my career is a string of fortunate accidents, but accidentally created a thing called Investor Ladder, which is a network of investors at all different stages from all over the UK who are interested in understanding the regional ecosystems and how to better collaborate with investors who are in territory. That network's now over 1,000 investors and from all over the world. And
wow.
One of the things that I will shamelessly plug through this podcast is
please do.
That led to our annual summit, which is called Climb. So this year's Climb 24, which we'll be hosting on the 5th and 6th of June in Leeds.
As a Leeds-based girl, I am a big fan of your decision to to host events in Leeds. Why Leeds and whereabouts, if you know yet, where will they be?
So why Leeds? We Climb came around because the Investor Ladder Network originally was talking about what's happening in each different city and how to better connect with the regional ecosystems. But the questions got bigger. And we were talking about things like diversity, inclusion, sustainability, future talent, social inclusion. And I was actually en route to Slush in Helsinki and thought, hang on, why am I getting on a plane to go to Helsinki where I'm probably going to meet mainly people from the UK? Why don't we have a fun festival style event? I'm actually based in Leeds, so it was a logical place to do this. And the venue works very well because we have taken over Leeds Dock for 2 days, which gives us access to a place called the Royal Armouries, which is a large museum with different styles and sizes of rooms, so we can make a real festival style event. So the stars were aligned. It seemed like the right place to do the event. We ran it last year for the first time. The feedback was phenomenal, both in terms of venue, the content, the atmosphere and the network. So it made sense to make that our home for 2024.
Yeah, and Liv, I can tell you it was a great event. It was, as Gordon said, it was that kind of festival vibe. It didn't feel overly corporate in terms of it wasn't, you know, meeting to meeting. It was very much interactive, lots of discussions, lots of breakouts, lots of fun and lots of people just networking and getting on with each other. It was great. So, and as a Leeds girl, you've got no excuse. You're definitely coming this year.
I'll be there. It's a 5-minute walk down the road for me. Yeah. So no, definitely no excuse. That sounds incredible. How come, just to go back to you a little bit, Gordon, how come you chose this industry to kind of work in? Do you have credentials in terms of, you know, venture capital investing, or what was the thought process there?
As I say, kind of a string of fortunate accidents. So back in the 90s, there wasn't a massive venture capital industry. I was fortunate to join a small business out of university. We grew very, very rapidly. We didn't take external funding, but ultimately floated on the main market. And my part of the organization was working with what we called emerging technologies. there were e-commerce companies essentially, but it was not the .com, but it was the infrastructure behind that. So essentially all of the clients I was working with were venture capital backed businesses or were looking for venture backed funding. We grew at such a pace. We didn't know what we were doing. I was 20 odd years old, grew a team from 2 to I think 60 odd people at its peak when I left. Wow. There was no talk of culture. There was no talk about engagement of your staff. No one knew anything about those things.
A steep learning curve for everyone, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. So, but all the founders I was working with were having the same issue. They were growing businesses and not understanding the people element. So because we were in a people consultancy, I decided that that was the opportunity to create a business working with those founders. And we got flooded, absolutely flooded with every single early stage business on the planet, I think, wanted to work with us because they all had the same problem. And I just thought, companies like you can do the heavy lifting. You know what you're talking about. You know what good looks like in terms of a business. So it made logical sense to work with my network of VCs that I worked with over the years. And essentially that was where the deal flow came from. So, and then on a very Mickey Mouse level over that time, I have what I call my told you so fund. So when we exited the first business, I had the genius idea that I would invest in some early stage businesses. My wife quite rightly said, you'll lose all the money. So as long as there's a pound in the pot, as long as there's a pound in that pot, you can't say I told you so. And yeah. I was fortunate that a couple of those businesses have done very well. So thankfully she hasn't had the opportunity to say, told you so yet. So
not on that anyway. History I'm sure she has other things. But
yeah. Oh yeah, 100%. Not on the fun. So I guess there's a kind of mixture of my own personal experience working in a high growth business, my network of investors who I've worked with over the time, and then my own kind of, as I say, Mickey Mouse, a very small level of the investments that I'll do myself. That's why the sector so a personal interest. And there's definitely a demand for what we do.
So how have you seen the market change since you kind of first started dipping your toe in the VC world, or since you started, you know, going from 2 to 60? You know, how's the VC world changed? How's the ecosystem changed? You know, and that's quite a big question, broad question. But
yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure that people don't want to listen to about 500 years worth of you know, what's happened in the last 30 years. But I think there's a number of things. That there's a lot more support for founders in the market than there certainly was in the 90s. When I said I was going to work exclusively with high growth businesses, my colleagues at the time said I was an idiot. It was very difficult. There's no money in it. Founders, and I can say this because I am one now, our founders are a nightmare. and all of those things were true. So there wasn't really much support around. Now there's a lot more, but it's a kind of double-edged sword because it's all the things that people said to me, and I knew going into it, my eyes were wide open. All of those things are true. Unfortunately, it's become fashionable. So like anything, when a market picks up, you get a number of people into this space now who, I guess, don't know what they're doing. They've never worked within an early stage business, have not been in investment. But it's, again, I can say this because I am one. Founders tend to be gullible, so we're the easiest people to sell to. Unfortunately, we're the hardest people to deliver to. So I think one of the things that we've seen is a lot more business support. But my advice to founders is you need to check that the quality is there. The other thing, the industry of investors is more mature as well. So I think you've got people who've been around the cycle of investing and who know what they're doing more. And then I'm sure we'll get into this of the technical elements of investing as well. As there's different schemes available, it's not one size fits all, the different types of funds, etc. So I think the whole market is a lot bigger, and we're seeing changes again happening. It would kind of keep going, like any industry goes through cycles, doesn't it, really?
Absolutely.
So that's as succinct as I can be, I'm afraid.
No, that's really useful, and I think it is I think that understanding of where the ecosystem has developed in the UK and how it's developed is important, because you can only understand what you've got now if you understand where it's come from. And I think, that's key. And I guess when you're doing Investor Ladder, Climb 24 or Climb 23 last year, and you're kind of building on those 30 years of evolution and change, that you're trying to add that next level of change. Is that fair?
It is, yeah. So I think that one of the things that we've seen through both Invest Ladder and Climb is everyone talks about a funding gap. There's also a knowledge gap. Mm-hmm. I was on a panel with an event called Convention of the North a couple of months ago. I was on a panel with a number of other investors, and we were asked a question about some of the challenges and some of the things that frustrate us as investors. So I was there with my told you so hat on. The biggest frustration to a lot of people is this kind of spray and pray approach of companies. They don't do their homework. They don't identify which are the right funds to go for. It is a really, like any industry, it's a really complicated and increasingly complicated landscape. So one of the things that we're here to do to try to help with is help people navigate that and think, actually, if you're a deep tech business in pre-seed mode or pre-revenue, these are the organizations that work within that space. Don't bother talking to a life science investor who does Series B and C and beyond, but actually helping people do their homework. And I think the real challenge for founders right now is there is a lot of stuff out there, so how they navigate that and how they do that, and equally for investors navigating the ecosystems, because there's a million and one new accelerators, incubators, business support brokers, whatever it may be. So how do we navigate those things? It is becoming increasingly difficult, I think.
It's a degree of matchmaking, isn't it? Yeah, I guess in terms of making sure the right people are speaking to the right people. Yeah.
In your time of kind of, obviously you're in a really unique position in the way that you are engaging with lots of different startup companies and across industries as well. But I think something that a lot of people would find really interesting from you is an understanding of what is the marker of success. You know, what are the traits that a founder should show for successful companies, or the kinds of things that they would do which would increase their chances, for example?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I get asked this a lot. So taking a step back, just to be clear, Invest Ladder isn't a broker. We don't charge for making introductions. It's just we're helping to improve the ecosystem, really. So what that allows us to do is get an honest view from both sides of the equation. So we genuinely are in that unique position where you hear multiple things. The single biggest thing that founders or companies don't talk around when they're going after investment is, what are they going to do that means that by the time they've spent your money, their business is worth more than it was before it started? So again, using jargon, I guess, really, is what's the value inflection that's going to come from that investment? So clearly, if someone's investing £1 million into a business, they want to make sure by the time that money is spent, the business is worth two or three million more than it was before that money went in. And often founders don't talk about that inflection point. The other thing that people talk about is where they're going to get to, but not how they're going to get there. So one of the things that we see a lot of the most successful businesses that we work with is, yes, they've got a vision and a mission, but they've got a plan of how they're going to get there. We called it a flight plan at one point. If you are a pilot and you want to fly from Manchester to London, you can't just get in a plane and fly. You have to talk to aero support and make sure that they are aero control and tell them the route you're going to go, how much fuel you're going to be, why you're going to go in that route, etc. And sometimes when we talk to founders or organizations looking for money, they don't have that plan. And then they don't have that capability, or looking at making sure they've got that capability to execute on that plan, either that it's within the team right now, or they're going to use the money to buy that. That they can say, well, we haven't got somebody who's got sales capability in the business, but we're going to start selling. So part of the investment is going to be to buy a salesperson. So I think a couple of things really to summarize that is having that clear plan and that demonstrating that capability to execute that plan, and why, when you've executed that plan, your business is going to be worth a lot more than it was before the money went in. A lot of people talk about investment, they talk about cash flow in the business, really. You know, I'm going to run out of money, so I need some money to keep me cash flow positive. This is an investment. So investors want to see an uplift and a return on that investment. So they're the two things that we see a lot, or the main two things that we see a lot.
I think one of the things that came up in a conversation I was having on a panel session recently was kind of very similar to that, but it was talking about not only kind of the market, how they're going to go about doing things or what have you, but it was also understanding their addressable market. And actually, doing that in a factual manner rather than just saying, well, there's, I think I made the point to somebody, well, you said if you're making shoes, you could say, well, there's nearly 7 billion people in the world. So that means there's 14 billion shoes out there. You know, that's not your addressable market. So actually how do you, in real term, do you actually make sure that you're understanding what that addressable market is so that can inform your business plan and your kind of plan of action? And I think that's something which we keep seeing coming up is that people come with almost spurious figures around addressable market and their plan of how they're going to conquer that addressable market in 2 to 3 years' time. And it's actually understanding that behind that, the steps to get there, which I guess you're kind of trying to help explain to them what they need to do.
Absolutely. It's really funny, isn't it? And how many times, I'm sure you see this as much, Sally, the other side of that, the other part of that is, and what the competition is, how many people have that dual axis and they're in the upper right-hand quartile with nobody else. Yep. Nobody else at all does whatever. And again, to me, that means you either haven't done your research or you think that we're daft. There's nothing which is that blue sky anymore, unfortunately, or fortunately. So actually being very clear of saying, we have got, and actually competition can make it validate the market better. So if you say, yes, we have got this here, so
it can validate the market and also explain your exit opportunities down the line. If you've got nobody in that market, then how do we know that somebody's going to be out there willing to or interested in buying in that market?
Yes, absolutely. And that's, again, goes back to what I was saying about varied levels of business support and advice that we see. The number of investment readiness workshops that I see people come off the back of, and actually what they're being taught to do is how to write a glossy pitch deck and not actually to be investment ready. I was, again, at a panel, and it was somebody from the Innovation Super Network summed this up very well and said, the pitch deck's the start of the journey, not meaning that you're investment ready, and all of the things that we talked about, having real in-depth insight into, as you say, the addressable market, the competition, how are you going to get there, how are you going to overcome adversity, how are you going to battle that, and what the exit is. That's investment. When you've got all of that stuff nailed down and show you can do it, that's more like investment readiness, not just having 10 slides that you can use to get in front of an investor.
That's very true.
It makes sense, doesn't it? Because it's like the dream element of when you're starting the business is like the main driver. That's the bit that's exciting. Maybe when you're coming down to actually planning out exactly how you're going to get to the dream, not as fun. And I think that is just human nature, but it's definitely an issue that we see. What would your advice be to those founders who are looking to kind of execute this exit readiness plan, for example?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? So you're absolutely right. When you sat there and you're creating your vision, I'm that person, right? The thought of sitting and writing a plan just drains every bit of enthusiasm out of my body. So I talk a good game but that goes back to team, doesn't it? So I have a COO to die for. That's her forte. That's her superpower. She takes someone described as my evil genius the other day, and turns that into reality.
Was that your wife again, by any chance?
Absolutely. In fact, it wasn't. It was one of my colleagues. But the idea is that we can have that vision, but if you haven't got the person around you, if it's not you, having that right team around you who fills in the gaps, who can make a difference. I think one of the things we see when we're going and doing an organisational design for a company is often the founders have created a team with people with the same skill set, the same mindset around them, whereas it's that assessment of what am I good at, what do I enjoy doing, and what bits can I afford to get other people to do, and as quickly as possible to be able to make that team as cohesive as possible. So last year at Climb 23, a good friend of mine, she's a former CTO of Microsoft in the US, came over to Climb, and she'd left Microsoft to join an early stage business. And she said when she was at Microsoft in a C-level position, she said, I didn't do anything. When I went into startup, I had to do everything.
Yep.
And she turned this, wasn't quite a startup, it was an early stage business. She turned it around and exited it in 9 months. Wow. And she said her skill within that was to get to a position where she didn't do a lot very as quickly as physically possible. So bringing in those key people into key roles. So she was sat at the top and looking at the strategy and developing the right relationships and pulling that in. And I think that's a real superpower of all the best CEOs, founders, whatever you want to call those individuals, that ability to pull together an amazing team and make that team operate is just something you cannot do without if you're going to grow a business.
Yeah, I think it takes a lot of reflection, doesn't it, to be able to do that, because first you have to be honest about your own limitations as a founder, which is very difficult to do as a person. Yeah. As a human being, you can totally relate to that. But if you do, and you do it quite quickly, and you delegate to the right team members, I can totally see why that would be Absolutely. A marker of success.
Yeah.
And it's hard to do for yourself. So this is what we do for a living, right? So I call it sitting on the bottom of the stairs moment. We've all had that where can I sit there and have to, or sitting in a dark room and that reflection. But it's too hard to do for yourself. So we've actually trained individuals who come and do it for us. So even though we do this all the time at CRSI, we're doing this all the time for investors and for businesses. When it comes to our own organization, you still need an external view. So to us, there are advisors and non-execs, but having that external view, because it is just too difficult. And actually, it takes a pretty big person to be able to rip themselves apart to the level you need to be able to do that and have that level of, I mean, I think, and I get commented that I'm very self-aware as where my weaknesses are, but it's still pretty tough because the people I need to bring in are people who are going to scare the life out of me, who are way better for a good reason.
Absolutely. You know?
So I agree. Absolutely.
Yeah. I think that is one of the early conversations we often have with companies that are new to raising capital. You know, if we're doing a pre or a seed round with them, it is helping them to try and understand where the gaps are in their team and yeah, where their skills lie. And sometimes that can be for a founder, they might be scientifically brilliant, but do you know what? They shouldn't be CEO long term. You know, they need to focus on the technical elements and bring in a CEO who can run the business and drive the growth, etc. And those are difficult conversations to be had, but you know, they have to be had for everyone's benefit. Otherwise, you're going to end up in 2-3 years' time wondering why you've missed all your targets and you've not done what you're planning to do. So I think that's something which we collectively, as an industry, I think are getting better at, but I still think there's a lot of work to be done as an industry about how we make sure we don't feel disenfranchised as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So interestingly, at Climb, we are we've got what we call the Uplift Squad. So there's on this Uplift Squad, there is investors, there's professionals in the functional area. So in the one that I'm involved in is the talent squad, and then C-level people who've been on the journey. And we're running workshops with those individuals to companies to be able to do exactly that, to give the toolkit to organizations to be able to say, this is how to do that. And we'll do them in marketing, we'll do them in talent, we'll do them in finance, we'll do them in business development. And that some will be on the main stage, some will be in small rooms with 20 to 30 people. And hopefully we can do that knowledge transfer, not by consultants doing this, but at the three different areas, people who've actually been there, done it, and you know, can walk the talk and talk about it's that tiny little thing. This is not there. Talent 101, it's a tiny little things that you get from experience. So I'm sure we'll be asking DeepBridge to get involved in those sessions as well.
I'm sure.
Are you saying this on the podcast so we have to? Yeah. We're now formally tied in. It's a good tactic.
It's on public record.
No,
we look forward to it. It's going to be a great event.
Definitely, yeah.
I was just going to ask you, Gordon, about what change have you seen over the years in terms of levelling up, in terms of, yeah. You know, the government made a big deal about levelling up agenda, obviously Leeds being the home for Climb 23, Climb 24. Have you seen a change? Are things working and what have you, and how have you seen that develop?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So we work across the globe, so and across the UK. A lot of what we've been doing with Invest Ladder and Climb is on the regional side. We talked about this before we came online, didn't we, about we did Bristol the other week. I'm not sure how Bristol snuck into the north, but...
it's outside of London. They won't know, Gordon.
But we see this across the region. So I have a catchphrase, which is money doesn't recognise geographical borders. You know, I think there's always been an interest for funds and investment managers to invest in great businesses, regardless of where they are. I think one of the challenges is that if you're not in a geographical location, it's often difficult to navigate that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's still the case. I think it is a complex area. So again, the analogy I often think is that if I go on a holiday or a trip to a new city that I've never been to, the first thing I'm going to do is probably eat in a chain restaurant. And after a few days of being there, I then identify where are the really nice places that are off the beaten track, etc. And the way you do that is by partnering up with and working with the people in the territory. Mm-hmm. So so I can't comment on government policy. That's not my forte. What I've seen happening, and I'd like to think InvestLadder and Climb have been a part of that and been instrumental in that, is that collaboration where if you look at the venture capital industry, and I guess it goes back to one of the questions at the beginning of why this industry, in my industry as an HR or talent consultancy, you don't really talk to your competitors. But in VC, you're competitive in some respects, but really collaborative in others.
Absolutely.
And everyone does tend to welcome each other with open arms. So if someone's coming up from London to the Northwest or to Yorkshire or the Northeast, usually the people on the ground will want to meet and do deals together, share deals, share information. So I think what I have seen more over the last probably 7 or 8 years is more of that collaboration happening. So that from a levelling up perspective, if that's the right word, I still think there is a massive knowledge gap. We find that if we talk to founders in the regions and ask them to name 5 of the right VCs that they should be talking to, most struggle to get 5. And if they do get 5, 4 of them will just be from their geographical area and probably not the right focus area or the right size. So I still think there's a lot of work to be done in that arena. And it's the education piece, I think, is quite key.
Education and visibility to build that collaboration.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen any other changes in the industry around kind of general diversification in terms of founders?
Diversity.
Not. Well, I'm saying diversity because I speak to financial advisors every day. Diversity. Sorry.
Yeah. So again, going back to my own background, I guess, really, and my own early part of my career, it's always been common sense to me that if I surround myself with people who think differently and who've seen things differently to me, we can solve problems quicker. So back in the day, it wasn't called diversity. It was just hiring the best team.
Yeah.
I think what's happening and is really good is, again, the heart of everything we talk about. And one of the main reasons why Climb exists as opposed to our traditional invest ladders is this is a subject that people are now starting to understand or want to understand. And a small invest ladder wasn't the forum to do that. We need a bigger platform. Again, I still think there's a lot of work to do there. We're doing some work with the combined authority here with an organization called Yorkshire Asian Business Association, different groups around how can we work within communities to help them understand that there's careers that probably they've never really heard of. I generally think smart founders don't need a lot of education as to why it's important. What they do need help with is how they get access to those communities and to those diverse groups, because often people work in silos. So I think we're seeing a lot more open willingness and keenness and enthusiasm to build more diverse teams. Mm-hmm. But I still think there's a lot of education of how, again, it goes back to the how, not the why. It's the how you tap into that. And we still get a lot of, one of my good friends who runs a thing called Include Me and D-List, who we work with here, we're bringing 100 black founders to Climb to run some workshops and sessions around access to finance. And she coined the phrase, I'm sure she didn't coin the phrase, but she talks about diversity washing, people who just tick the boxes. And we're still seeing that, you know, there's a business that presented to us just the other day where they've got a platform that essentially disguises your ethnic origin so that business support people wouldn't block you out. And I was like, well, that shouldn't be required. Actually, that's the worst thing I've ever heard in my life, because it just seems a joke, really. But there needs to be that connection to happen if we're going to grow businesses. And we do need to have conscious thought and be doing conscious things. We support a number of female founders, like Female Founders Rise, Lifted Ventures. We make sure those things are highlighted at Climb. What we've got to be careful as well, of course, is that we're not creating more silos.
Yeah.
You know, we need diversity to mean diversity, that if it's a female founders group, there's old white blokes like me in that room as well. Do you know that we're actually connecting the dots together? So, but again, I think we're making moves in the right direction. In some respect, I think we're nowhere near where we need to get to. You know, female founders are still struggling to raise money. There's still not enough women in the investment world right now. And you could go on forever. So I think we're starting to move in the right direction. Let's hope we continue to do that, and let's hope we can speed it up.
I think, interestingly as well, the way you answered the question when we asked you about diversity, you spoke about why it's beneficial for organisations to have a diverse board, etc. And it's that education that we need to start from, rather than the tick box exercise that you said. You know, as soon as people, it becomes ingrained in people that the benefits, etc., and why this is a positive, rather than just somebody told you to do this, will make a huge difference on individuals and behaviour thereafter. Yeah.
I think, again, that's what's really interesting. So someone called Zandra Moore, she's part of a task force, and they're using data to prove this in each. They've got regional data to prove this. And it is statistically female-led businesses outperform purely male-led businesses. Of course they do, because we just get distracted on stuff and don't do the planning bit or whatever it may be. That's usually stereotyping. But, you know, again, it goes back to, if you show the there is massive financial and economic benefit of having diverse teams.
Yeah.
And again, not least, there's a massive staffing shortage. We work in science and tech, yeah, right? So you've got to reach out to broader communities, otherwise you're going to be short of people. And equally, pretty dull place to work, wouldn't it, if you were all the same and all agreeing and nodding with each other all the time. So from an employee engagement perspective, there's a benefit as well.
No, definitely. Definitely.
No, it's really interesting. I was just thinking of that example that you gave. I actually heard of an example the other day of life science early stage businesses just hiring women and calling them co-founders, but really they had no input or idea of what the business was about, just to tick that box to make them more appealing. And that is, oh God, that is just such a backward step, isn't it? And really defeats the point.
Can you imagine if you were employed in a business just because you were a whatever?
Yes.
Just like on every level, can you imagine that you think, oh, well, I'm the token woman or the token disabled
Andrew,
person?
Not why I was hired here.
I can neither confirm nor deny. Yeah.
It's just on every level, it's awful, isn't it? We do get that quite a lot. Oh, we need to hire a C-level person or a non-executive. It needs to be a woman. No, you need to hire the very best person you can get. You need to have a clear, transparent process. You need to have it's difficult because of my background. So I can't walk in the shoes of people who've suffered from this. But I think 90% of the problem is that I'm seeing with the founders that we work with isn't that they have a bias. It's just they don't get access to they don't cast the net wide enough. They go to recruiters who use the same database of the same people who've done the same job before. You've just got to be more creative.
Yeah.
And when you get out into different talent pools and different areas from hiring, you find those rock stars that you wouldn't get from a normal recruiting process. So I think it's more designing your process that gets access to the right people and having conscious thought that you need a diverse talent pool rather than actually positive discrimination.
Yeah.
That's the key.
Absolutely.
And by default, I mean, it's funny, we had at Climb 23, I think 60-something% of our speakers were women. We had cross-section from gender neutral, people from different ethnicity, across every spectrum of diversity, kind of by accident or by default. No one actually went, oh, we've not got enough women, oh, we've not got enough men, we've not got enough black people. It was, let's just get the best speakers we can get to an event. And then we looked at the thing and it was like, wow, this is really cool, you know. And it was because how we cast the net, we just went out to everybody who had done exciting and great stuff. We had more OBEs at the thing than I've ever seen in my life. We had people who've run businesses. We had investors. We had people from the US, from Europe, from Australia, from Asia, all come to a relatively small event of a couple of thousand people in Leeds that no one ever heard of. And it just covered all areas, all cross-sections of society, really.
Brilliant. It's brilliant. So last question then. We've kind of looked at the past, we've looked over the last 30 years already, etc. We've looked at the future, but in terms of the enterprise investment scheme itself, obviously 2024 is now the 30th anniversary of the enterprise investment scheme. What impact have you seen of EIS Capital and the scheme itself on the UK ecosystem?
So despite the fact I look older, I wasn't around 30 years ago in business. I was as a human being, but I wasn't in this space. So about 24 years I've been doing this. So, but what we've seen, what I see, and maybe it's the cluster of people I work with, is I think one of the benefits of EIS and SCIS as well now is that the new investors, as in individuals, can get into the market at a lower risk. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I'm really passionate about is getting more, again, diverse investors into the industry. So whether that be age, whether that be ethnicity, whether it be gender, whatever, the beauty of EIS and SEIS allows people to take that jump a little bit earlier than maybe they would, and partner up with organizations like DeepBridge to say, you know what you're doing, I'm kind of learning, so here this is, and I get the tax relief and the benefits of doing that. I think, so that's from an investor perspective, and hopefully that broadens and accelerates the breadth of a talent pool coming into the sector as investors. I think the other thing from a company's perspective is, no founder's going to agree with me, but it's probably easier to raise money at that earlier stage than, I know it's really tough now, it's the most complex market I've seen in the last 24 years, but if we look at it as a trend, it has been, it has become easier and easier to raise money. There is a lot of money out there. There's a lot of dry powder out there. Of course there is right now, but I think so from a talent pool perspective, it allows people to get into the market better. People like myself, I wouldn't have been investing when I had a relatively small amount of money to invest. I wouldn't have done that. If I was putting the whole lot at total, I probably would actually. But that's because I'm a slow learner, I guess. But I think a lot of people are doing that. And that, if that broadens the diversity in that space, then that's got to be a winner. And absolutely. Then from a founder's perspective, to be able to go out and raise money at an earlier stage has got to be a positive. Let's hope it continues.
Yeah, Liv and I were talking recently to one of our founders who is not from the UK originally, but has come to the UK largely because of EIS and being able to have that that kind of democratization of early stage capital, and without being royally screwed by some chancing private equity firm putting a load of prefs against them, etc. So there's things like that which I guess are not necessarily unconsidered consequences of EIS, but actually are the beneficial elements of it, which means that it's an appealing place for people to be. So anyway, I'm wittering now. So right, Gordon, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it. Great to catch up with you. Liv and I will see you at Climb 24, and anybody interested in the ecosystem, I recommend that they just Google Climb 24 and get their tickets booked.
So, can you remind us of the dates one last time?
Yeah, so it's the 5th and 6th of June. It's in Leeds Dock. We will have over 200 speakers, over 50 workshops, masterclasses, roundtables, We've got a big expo hall with international delegations. So anyone, whether it's not just about companies looking to raise money, it's about growing your business. This is about how everyone thinks they need money until they get money, and then they realize that they needed the money to do stuff. And so we're about the doing stuff. It's about how you, yes, absolutely, it's access to potential investors, partners, clients, whatever it may be. But the focus is very much around how do you accelerate the growth of your business, whether that be a very early stage business or companies that are quite a way along the journey and looking to just get to the next step.
Brilliant.
Gordon, I can't wait to see your hard work come to fruition at the event later this year, but thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Gordon.
Thank you very much. Great to speak to you.
Thank you for joining us.
If you have any topics you'd like covering in future Deep Rich Discovery podcasts, please email us at discovery@deepbridgecapital.com. We look forward to seeing you soon. This podcast was brought to you by Deep Rich Capital LLP. DeepBridge is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Please note that investments discussed are both illiquid and high risk and won't be suitable for all investors and should be considered as part of a diversified portfolio. The content of this podcast should not be construed as financial or taxation advice. We recommend investors seek appropriate professional financial advice. Any views expressed may no longer be current and may have already been acted upon.